As you all know, the title of this lecture series, Who Does Torah Belong To? Or for those of us who are stricter about grammar, To Whom Does Torah Belong? Is going to be an exploration of questions about what happens when the people around us think that Torah actually does not belong to us. What are the motivations that might compel us to try to control who has access to Torah? When is that possibly appropriate, or when might it have positive results? When does it actually harm? And finally, what do you do? How do you critique the establishment when you feel that they are keeping what I'll call inappropriate control over Torah? We're going to begin the first of those adventures this week with a class devoted to the question of what do you do when your Torah doesn't belong? And by that, I mean, what do you do when, for whatever reason around you, people either don't recognize your Torah as valuable? What do you do when they don't see you as belonging to the Torah learning world? What are the options available to you when actually people see your questions in Torah as dangerous? And in order to explore these questions tonight, we're going to look at a character identified, a figure, I should say, identified by several different names. And those names are Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Nohorai. We'll begin with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Who is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach? Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is one of the four main students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the sage who really leads the Jewish people, as it is at that point, through the destruction of the temple and begins to rebuild a new Judaism centered around Torah study in its ashes. And Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who will be studying tonight, the first of these figures whose Torah does not belong, is, when we first meet him, actually Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's most prized student. We'll jump into the first source from Bavli Eruvin and see a little bit about why that might be. Actually, the first source we're going to begin with, an explanation of why does this one person have so many names? Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, who we are going to begin with. Why is he also sometimes called Rabbi Meir? Why is he also sometimes called Rabbi Nohorai? This source will explain to us the multifaceted figure that we're going to be looking at tonight. Rabbi Acha bar Chanina said, "It is revealed and known before the one who spoke and the world came into being," meaning God, "that in the generation of Rabbi Meir, there was no one of the sages who is his equal." Just to make sure we're all following, Rabbi Meir is one of the people identified with Rabbi Nohorai and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And Rabbi Acha bar Chanina begins speaking about Rabbi Meir and says, "There was no one in his generation who was his equal. He was a genius. He was a visionary. However, why then didn't the sages establish the halakha in accordance with his opinion? If he's such a genius, if he's such a visionary, why don't we rule in halakha according to what he says? It is because his colleagues were unable to ascertain the profundity of his opinion. As he would state with regard to a ritually impure item, that it is pure and display justification for that ruling. And likewise, he would state with regard to a ritually pure item that it is impure and display justification for that ruling." We could spend 3 weeks just on those few sentences. We are not going to. What I want to make sure we note here is that Rabbi Acha bar Chanina is saying there is something about Rabbi Meir's logic that confounds his companions. It seems to turn everything on its head. It leads them down paths where it seems potentially dangerous to go. And so even though he is known as a genius, even though he is known as a visionary, his colleagues refuse to rule according to him. They, in essence, say, your Torah is somehow dangerous. Your Torah does not belong here. And we'll pick up that strand later when we come back to Rabbi Meir. Let's keep reading. "It was taught in a Braita Rabbi Meir was not his name, rather Rabbi Nohorai was his name. Here's the first of the identification of this figure who comes down to us in three names, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Nohorai, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arah. And why was he called by the name Rabbi Meir? If his real name was Rabbi Nohorai, why do we call him Rabbi Meir? It is because he illuminates Meir, the eyes of the sages in matters of halacha. Note, by the way, we have something confusing here. I would say potentially confounding. On the one hand, Rabbi Meir's companions refuse to rule like him. They find his rulings potentially dangerous. They push them to the side. But on the other hand, we are told he still illuminates their eyes. I would say quite literally, he enlightens them. There is something about his Torah that is enlightening, even as it is seen as dangerous and something to be potentially put aside. And Rabbi Nohorai was not the name of the Tana known by that name. Rabbi Nohorai wasn't his real name. Rather, Rabbi Nechemiah was his name. And some say Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was his name. Again, to remind us, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the prize student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, living as the temple is destroyed and in the generation that is trying to rebuild from its ashes. And why was he called by the name Rabbi Nohorai? It was because he enlightens the eyes of the sages in matters of halacha. We have encountered for now this three-part figure. Rabbi Nohorai, also known as Rabbi Meir, also known as Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. And what each of those figures has in common is that somehow their Torah is rejected by their colleagues. We're going to start with Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, see what that looks like for him, and see the different strategies he uses to respond when the community around him says, "I'm sorry, your Torah does not belong here." We begin in Pirkei Avot, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is talking about his students, his five disciples, and singing their praises. He has beautiful metaphors for each of them. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five disciples, and they were these: Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania, Rabbi Yossi the priest, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, and our hero tonight, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Yochanan used to list their outstanding virtues. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is a plastered cistern which doesn't lose a drop. Let's just interrogate that metaphor for a moment. A plastered cistern that doesn't lose a drop. That seems to indicate he has an incredible memory. He is able to take in all sorts of Torah from other places and make sure that none of it is lost. And indeed, although we won't be studying him tonight, that is one of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's prime characteristics. In contrast to him, however, is our hero of the night, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is like a spring that ever gathers force. Another way of saying that is an ever-strengthening fountain. These are both water metaphors, but whereas Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's other disciple, has a brilliance for taking in information, remembering information, making sure that none of it is forgotten, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the student we'll be studying tonight, the student who is identified with Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Nohorai, is an ever-producing fountain, an ever-strengthening fountain. He has water of his own, which spreads, which strengthens. And that's an amazing thing. It means he has incredible ideas. It means he has brilliance. It means he can produce. What, though, is the danger of a never-strengthening fountain? A never-strengthening fountain has nothing to keep its waters contained. And that may be one of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's weaknesses, as we'll see it as the text goes on. Abba Shaul said in his name, "If all the sages of Israel were on one side of the balance, of a scale, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus also with them, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was on the other scale, he would outweigh them all." We have here a metaphor for which of these students is the most important. Let's remind ourselves, why is that such an important question? It's an important question because living in the immediate aftermath of the destruction of the temple, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is probably trying to figure out which of these students is going to be charged with carrying on his leadership after him. And I would say more specifically, which of these students has the ability to rebuild Judaism in such a way that it will flourish and survive after it has almost died entirely. We have two obvious choices here. We have the plastered cistern that doesn't lose a drop. That is not the direction this text goes in. Instead, it puts its money on Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, the ever-strengthening fountain, the one who has this uncontained brilliance, the one who is able to produce novel ideas. I want us to note, though, already in this metaphor is the roots of what will become Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's main problem. The metaphor here is that of a scale. If all of the sages were on the other side and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach were on the second side, he would outweigh them all. And that's wonderful, but it also means that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach stands alone. And in a world that's trying to recover from near destruction, someone who stands alone may not actually be able to help the people recover. We'll see what happens with that. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to them, "Go forth and observe which is the right way to which a man should cleave. What virtues do you need to live a good life?" He's asking them to answer that question, which obviously is a question that human beings ask themselves again and again and again. Rabbi Eliezer, meaning Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, said, "A good eye." Rabbi Yoshua said, "A good companion." Rabbi Yossi said, "A good neighbor." Rabbi Shimon said, "Foresight." Rabbi Elazar said, "A good heart." This is going to be at the core of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's Torah. What is he concerned about? He is concerned about matters of the heart. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to them, "I prefer the words of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, for in his words, your words are included." Now, I want us to notice two things. And all of this, again, is about building background to who is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach? What is it about him that causes his colleagues to say, "Your Torah doesn't belong here"? And how does he cope with that? What strategies does he employ? Already here, we have the root of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's Torah. He cares about the heart. He cares about what is internal to a person. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looks at that and says, "That's all you really need in the world. That's what you need to make you a good person. That's what you need to live a good life." And maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is right. Maybe in the good heart, all of the other virtues are included. But I want us to re-examine that. Let's look at two of the things you need to live a good life that are listed. Rabbi Yoshua said, "A good companion," and Rabbi Yossi said, "A good neighbor." Despite what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, a good heart might not necessarily guarantee you those. And again, that speaks to the possibility that is going to come to the forefront, the possibility of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's isolation and loneliness. He may not quite understand that in this world, you need companions in addition to what is inside of you. Or at the very least, you need companions if your Torah is going to take root. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's son died, his students came to comfort him. Now, I'm going to warn everyone, this is going to be a model of, I sometimes say that in rabbinical school, they should have a class that is called "Don't Do This," where you walk into class, in big capitals on the board are the words "don't do this." And they tell you the things that you absolutely should never do. Most of those will probably involve things you should not do at a Shiva visit. And I would say many of the things in this story fall into that category. That's the advance warning. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is sitting Shiva and his students come in one by one to comfort him. And I want us, as we read this story, I'm going to ask everyone to pay attention to the following questions. What strategies are the students employing in order to comfort Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? What is the content of the Torah that they're teaching? And why doesn't it work? Rabbi Eliezer entered and sat before him, saying, "Rabbi, may I say something to you?" Rabbi Yochanan replied, "Speak." He told him, "Adam had a son who died, and he accepted comfort." That, of course, is Hevel. He is murdered by Adam's other son, Cain. And he's saying, look, Adam also had a son who died. He moved on. Where does scripture speak of his accepting comfort? As it is said, Adam again knew his wife, meaning it goes on to say that Adam knew his wife, Chava. She conceived and they had another child. So too, you should find comfort. Again, this could be taught under big letters. Do not do this. Do not walk into a shiva and say to someone, other people have moved on from a loss, so should you. He replied, and here we see that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has a bit of a sense of humor. Is it not enough that I have my own troubles that you remind me of the sorrows of Adam? Take two. Rabbi Yeshua entered and said to him, may I say something to you? He said, speak. He told him, Job's sons and daughters all perished on the same day, and yet he was comforted for his loss of them. We're raising the stakes here. Now, from one son who died, it's sons and daughters who died. And yet he was comforted. You too should find comfort. Where does scripture speak of his accepting comfort? As it is said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He replied, is it not enough that I have my own troubles that you remind me of the sorrows of Job? Sarah Brooks says they're telling him that there is nothing special, original about his circumstances. Excellent. Mark Stepner says being didactic or homiletic, beautiful. Sarah Brooks, you don't have it so bad. Follow the examples of others. And Bracha Lieberman notes they want to speak before him. Reinfeld adds to that bad timing, premature. And I think it's all of that. I'm going to minimize your pain. I'm going to tell you other people have gone through this before you. And it speaks in a way to the way that they are employing Torah itself. What are they doing? They're saying, how do you learn Torah? How do you use Torah? You go and you find a story, an example of someone who seems to resemble you somehow, and you fit yourself into that box. What is Torah about? It is about taking a case, saying, that must be the ideal, and I will mold myself. I will conform to that. And I think, as we all know, especially when we're going through the times that feel most emotionally sharp, maybe, or most emotionally not only heavy, most emotionally valent, we actually want something different. We want to be told, I see you in your unique circumstance, and that matters. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach entered. Now the story changes. When Rabbi Yochanan saw him, he told his servant, gather my clothing and prepare to follow me to the bathhouse. Rabbi Elazar is a great man, and I shall not withstand him. What does that mean? What's he indicating? While you are in a state of mourning, you are not supposed to bathe according to halacha, especially during Shiva, during that time. Rabbi Yochanan sees Rabbi Elazar ben Arach entering, his favorite student, and he says, I know that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is going to say something that will comfort me so much that I will feel ready to transition out of this state of mourning and go to the bathhouse after speaking to him. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach entered and sat down before Rabbi Yochanan. He said to him, I will give you an analogy. And as we read this, I want to note one thing. One is, I don't think the theology here would work for many people in the 21st century. So we've been warned. But the other is, I want us to pay attention to what is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach doing differently How is his Torah, his use of Torah, his idea about what Torah is, how is it different from the people who came before him? Rabbi Elazar ben Arach entered and sat down before Rabbi Yochanan. He said to him, I will give you an analogy. This is like a man with whom the king has entrusted a deposit of some value. Each and every day that man would wail and moan, oh, for the time that I will return this deposit in peace and fullness. So you, Rabbi, had a son. He studied Torah, Chumash, Navi, writings, Mishnah, laws, and narratives. And he departed this world without sin. You should take comfort that you have returned your deposit in peace and fullness. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, Elazar, my son, you have comforted me the way people should comfort. Now, I want to say again, this is not necessarily theology for the 21st century, or for many of us in the 21st century. I'm sure some people might find it comforting. But I want us to pay attention to what is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach doing differently? This man who said, what do you need in the world in order to live a good life? You need a good heart. How does he see Torah differently? How is he using Torah differently? Sarah Brooks says, this one at least acknowledges sorrow. Yes, he is not looking at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and saying, other people had it worse. Other people had it worse and they moved on. He is looking at him and saying, you had one son and that son mattered. Let's talk about him. Let's talk about your relationship. I'm going to read some other responses. Mark Stepner says, being present and connecting to Hashem. Yes, you get the impression here that he's sitting there and he's looking at him in the eye and he's talking to him about, how do you think about the relationship between you and God in this moment, and you and God and your son? And I would say, maybe go even further and say, how can I frame this for you in a way that you don't see this as a punishment? How do I frame this for you in a way that you still see your time with your son as something precious, as something that other people valued and that God valued? Noah Hamstrom adds that Rabbi Elazar reflects the heart of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I think that's absolutely right. He's looking at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and saying, I know you. I know what matters to you. I know you. I know that Torah matters to you most of all in the world. And I'm going to tell you, your son knew that. Your son absorbed that. Your son appreciated your values. You shared that with your son. And in that, he's doing what I think everyone wants at their core during Shiva, which is to hear the other people around them recognize actually who that lost loved one really was. And know that they were really seen for who they were. One thing that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach does here, one more thing that I want us to note, is he sees Torah in a different way. Torah isn't about, there is this case and you must take yourself and conform to it. Try to fit yourself into precedent. He sees it as a way of offering new ideas suited for the person in front of him. This is a parable. What's a parable? A parable is a way of fitting the circumstances in front of you, using them as the jumping off point to create a story that incorporates Torah, that incorporates God, that incorporates how we might understand this in a theological context. But it always uses the situation in front of you as the starting point. And that's what Rabbi Elazar ben Arach does. He sees Torah as something that is able to respond to the moment, not as something that is just about precedent. I also want to note, Judy Freiler just said, I don't find his comments to be comforting at all. I just want to say before I move on, I personally agree if this was, God forbid, if I were in this circumstance and it was said to me, I would not react well. I think we have to think, though, about how would this land in a very, very different context for a very different person. But I don't think any of us have to think, yes, this is how you comfort someone in today's day and age. I would, God forbid, never want someone to come out of here and say this is a good thing to say at a Shiva. I want us to see one more aspect of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's Torah before we move on to, and why doesn't he belong? Why can't he fit in the context in which he lives? The sages taught. This is from Talmud Chagiga 14b. An incident occurred involving Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was riding on a donkey and was traveling along the way. And his student, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, was riding a donkey behind him. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said to him, "My teacher, teach me one chapter in the design of the divine chariot." What's the design of the divine chariot? The design of the divine chariot is a phrase that is used in the Gemara and later literature that seems to be about some sort of very esoteric mysticism. Esoteric mysticism having to do with possibly the makeup of God's divine chamber itself, something about the nature of God that is meant to be hidden from most human beings. And he says to Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, "Rabbi, teach me some of this. Teach me some of this esoteric wisdom." He said to him, "Have I not taught you? And one may not expand the design of the divine chariot to an individual unless he is a sage who understands on his own accord." Meaning, my student, this is not something that can be taught. This is something that must be intuited. This is something that after a long period of study of all sorts of parts of Torah, must come out of you yourself. And again, we have here, it seems, an implicit reference to this part of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's personality. He can create new things. He is the overflowing fountain. And we're about to be confronted with a moment in which he does indeed exactly that. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said to him, "My teacher, allow me to say before you one thing you taught me." It's a very beautiful moment. Rabbi Yochanan has just said, "I can't teach you this. You have to come up with it for yourself." And even then, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach says, "Okay, but in a way you taught me this. Let me say before you something that in some way you actually taught me." He said to him, "Speak." Immediately, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai alighted from the donkey and wrapped his head in a cloak in a manner of reverence and sat on a stone under an olive tree. Rabbi Elazar said to him, "My teacher, for what reason do you alight from the donkey?" Meaning Rabbi Yochanan gets off his donkey, he goes and sits on the ground, he is hiding his face in his cloak, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach looks at him and says, "Rabbi, what's going on? Why are you doing this?" He said, "Is it possible that while you are expounding the design of the divine chariot, and the divine presence is with us, and the ministering angels are accompanying us, that I should ride on a donkey?" Meaning Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looks at him and says, "I know what's about to happen. As soon as you open your mouth, the divine presence is going to descend and the angels are going to sing." And I want us to note how much trust Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has in his student, how much he believes in him, how much he sees this ability in him. Immediately, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach began to discuss the design of the divine chariot and expounded. And fire descended from heaven and encircled all the trees in the field. And all the trees began reciting song. What song did they recite? "Praise the Lord from the earth, sea monsters in all depths, fruit trees and all cedars, praise the Lord." An angel responded from the fire saying, "This is the very design of the divine chariot, just as you expounded." Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stood and kissed Rabbi Elazar ben Arach on his head and said, "Blessed be God, Lord of Israel, who gave Abraham a son like you, who knows how to understand, investigate, and expound the design of the divine chariot. Happy are you, our father Abraham, that Elazar ben Arach came from your loins." I want us to pause for a moment, and I want us to think about, who is this person? Who is Rabbi Elazar ben Arach? What is the content of his Torah? And that will prepare us, I think, for, and what goes so terribly wrong? Why can he not belong? When are we situated? We're situated at a moment after the destruction of the temple. We're situated in a moment where the survival of Judaism itself is at stake. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looks at his student, who says, "What matters is the heart." who says, I am going to teach Torah that is not about finding a past case and saying people have to conform their lives to it, but starts with the people in front of me, what matters to them, and then manages to build a Torah framework from it, who speaks words of divine chariot and calls down the angels and causes the very trees in the field to dance. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, that's the future. That's the future of Judaism. That is who has to lead us forward. But it seems Rabbi Elazar ben Arach's colleagues don't agree. And I want us to think about this for a moment. Why might Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, to his colleagues at least, not be the person who they want to lead forward in a new Jewish world? Why might his Torah for them not be the Torah that this moment calls for? This Torah, the Torah of the heart, the Torah of the overflowing fountain, the ever strengthening genius, the one who is saying Torah has to be about the people in front of me and creating a Torah framework from that. Why in this moment post-destruction might they feel that actually is not what we need right now? Sarah Brooks says it's about power. And I want to acknowledge that and say that's very possible. Let's think about what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says from the very start. If he was on one side and all the rest of them were on the other side, he would outweigh them all. That's a very hard thing for a group of students to hear. And it may be that they are actually not willing to live in a world like that, where the lone genius is the one who outweighs everyone else. Rachel Lieberman says they might be longing for the Torah they lost in the destruction. Yeah, let's go there for a moment. Elliot Dine says something similar. They're in a destabilizing time and need stable, clear rules, can't be personal and changing. Reinfeld says there's no structure in Elazar ben Arach, just inspiration. Post-destruction, the people need a semblance of structure. Yeah, let's talk about that. It may very well be that for all that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looks and says, this is beautiful, this is wonderful, there is genius here, there is renewal here, his students look around and say, we have lost so much, and what we need right now is actually to dig in and make sure we don't lose anymore. We need to figure out a clear, cogent way of talking about Torah. We need actually stability. We need structure. We need, for example, although he'll have his own problems in the future, the plastered cistern that doesn't lose a drop. We can't have a world, we can't have a Torah that's only about subjectivity, about the individual. We need a Torah that will carry us forward. I think all of that is true. And for whatever reason, we see that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach seems to understand that his Torah doesn't belong, or that his colleagues feel his Torah doesn't belong. Let's see how that plays out. Rabbi Chelbo said, the wine of Phrygia and the waters of Demosa deprived Israel of the 10 lost tribes. It's an esoteric statement that we are not going to go into right now. However, there is something about these places that is associated both with forgetting and with massive loss for the Jewish people. 10 of the 12 lost tribes. And that is going to be the introduction to how Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, according to this story, loses his Torah. Once Rabbi Elazar ben Arach happened to come there, to Phrygia and Demoset, and he was drawn after them and his learning was forgotten. There's something very poignant about this. The ever-strengthening fountain is drawn after the waters. There's nothing containing Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. He is drawn after the waters. I once taught this text in a classroom and we were thinking about what would lead Rabbi Elazar ben Arach to go in search of these waters. And someone in the class, I'll never forget this, said, well, it seems that this story takes place after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai died. And maybe Rabbi Elazar ben Arach needs to go off for a while to try to find everything that he lost in his teacher. Whatever the reason, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach goes off on his own, and according to this story, his learning was forgotten. When he returned, he stood to read from a Torah scroll and was supposed to read the verse, "This month shall be for you, HaChodesh Hazeh Lechem." That is the first of the commandments, the first of the mitzvot that appear in the Torah. That is where God gives the mitzvah of Rosh Chodesh. And instead he read, "Have their hearts become deaf? HaCharesh HaYalibam." Let's just make sure we understand how one could make this mistake. These phrases actually look remarkably similar if you see them in a Torah scroll. The Dalet and the Resh are remarkably similar. The Zion, if you just cut off the bottom, looks remarkably like a hey, making hazeh into haya. Lechem, if you just add a little line, can turn into a bet, and you have, instead of lechem, libam. And on the surface of this story, that seems to be exactly what happens. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, somehow in going off on his own, has forgotten all of his learning. And he now is in such a state that the once brilliant man can no longer read a simple verse from a Torah scroll. That's one layer of interpretation. Another way of reading this story, though, is that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, now back with his colleagues, is honored with the reading of the Torah, is told to read this verse, that the first of the mitzvot, halacha, halacha, which by nature is about rules, is about structure. And instead, he sees his colleagues around him and gets up and cries out, "Hecharesh hayalibam," have their hearts become deaf? And let's remind ourselves, what does Rabbi Elazar ben Arach care about? He cares about the heart. And he's looking around at his colleagues, perhaps in this reading, and saying, "You want me to read about mitzvot? Ask first about your hearts. Ask about whether your hearts have become insensible to what actually matters." But the sages don't understand it that way. The sages prayed and asked for God to have mercy on him, and his learning was restored. Meaning, they can only understand him as having lost all his knowledge. He gets up and he yells about, "Do your hearts know what matters?" And all they hear is nothing, is a man who's lost his learning. All they hear is someone who got the verse wrong. And in an act of compassion, if not an act of understanding, they pray for him. They pray for his learning to come back. And according to the story, that's indeed what happened. And that is what we learned in a Mishnah that Rabbi Nohurai says. Again, reminding us, Rabbi Nohurai is identified as Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. "Exile yourself to a place of Torah and do not say that it will follow you. As if you are in a place of Torah, your colleagues will establish it in your hands, and do not rely on your understanding alone." We're given a very nice, I'll say, moral of the story. What's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is you can't do it alone. Your Torah doesn't belong. It's not that it doesn't matter, but it's that the solution can never be going off on your own. The solution cannot be, I will go off on its own and I will on my own and I will hope that other people follow me. This is saying, if you're telling a story about what it means when your Torah doesn't belong and what is available to you, that is not an acceptable strategy. Now, I want us to pay attention for a moment. To remind us, we are told that Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is identified with Rabbi Nohurai. And why is Rabbi Nohurai called Rabbi Nohurai, according to the first source that we saw? Because he would enlighten the eyes of his peers. And that's a happy ending for him in some ways. His learning is restored, his study is restored, and he produces Torah that belongs. He produces Torah that his colleagues are able to hear. But what did that text say exactly? That text said he enlightened the eyes of his colleagues in what? In halacha. And there's something very important there. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach learns again how to talk to his colleagues. He learns how to teach Torah in a way that they are able to hear. But it's different than it was before. It's no longer about making the angels come down and the trees sing. It's no longer about, let me talk to you about people's hearts. It's changing his vernacular into something they are able to absorb. Now, I want to bring us back to our topic for today, when your Torah doesn't belong. So far, we've been presented with two strategies. The first strategy, we're told, is not a successful one. Go off on your own, see if people will follow you. And according to this story, at least, that's too big a gamble to take. The second, though, is successful, but also has its cost. Learn to teach your Torah, but in a vernacular that others will be able to hear. Learn to teach your Torah, but you might say translated or masked. And there are some things about that that are obviously wonderful. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach manages to live out his life among colleagues still teaching Torah. But there's something about it that is also tragic, in that he's been tamed in some ways. He has had to learn to translate his Torah in a way that maybe means that some of it gets lost along the way. That means that the angels will no longer come down and means that the trees will no longer sing. I want us to note, by the way, there will be cost to every one of the strategies that we see tonight. We're going to see at least two more. I'm not going to lie, there is no silver bullet here. But I do want us to ask the question for each of these: what are the benefits? What are the costs of this particular strategy? Rabbi Meir is interesting for a host of reasons. To remind us, he is also identified as Rabbi Nohorai. And we are told that he enlightened the eyes of his colleagues in halacha, but they didn't rule like him because he went places that they were not able to go. We can talk for hours about all the ways in which Rabbi Meir features that way in different stories. But right now, I want us to look at one particular one where he gets kicked out of the Beit Midrash. A very solid metaphor for when your Torah doesn't belong. You are literally expelled from the Beit Midrash, told you are no longer allowed here. And I want us to look at what Rabbi Meir does. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel commanded that those present, and they expelled Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan from the study hall as punishment. Rabbi Meir is luckier than Rabbi Elazar ben Arach in some ways. Yes, he is expelled, but he's not alone. And what did Rabbi Meir do when he was expelled? Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan would write difficulties, questions, challenging questions, on a scrap of paper and would throw them there into the study hall. Those difficulties that were resolved. As for those that were not resolved, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan wrote the resolutions on a scrap of paper and threw them into the study hall. I want us to pay attention to this because there's something fabulous here. You can expel me, but I will not stop engaging with you. You can tell me that my Torah doesn't belong, but you cannot keep out my questions. This is a very powerful metaphor. You can picture Rabbi Meir sitting in the courtyard, throwing the papers over. And indeed, the people inside the study house find that they can't ignore the questions. The questions are good ones. The challenges are good ones. And what's more, when they can't find answers, Rabbi Meir offers important ones. This is what I'll call strategy three. So far, we've seen walking away. We've seen changing your vernacular, trying to speak in a way that others around you will be able to hear. And here we find something else. Here we find saying, yes, I will stay outside the Beit Midrash. You can tell me that my presence is not appreciated there, but you cannot ignore my questions. It is continuing to engage even when you have been rejected. Let's continue in the source. Rabbi Yossi said to the sages, how is it that the Torah embodied in these preeminent scholars is outside and we are inside? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, let us admit them into the study hall, but we will penalize them in that we will not cite halacha in their names. Atara Cohen asked here, is this the Rabbi Meir who is considered the Tanakama, meaning when you have an anonymous Mishnah, it is thought to be in the name of Rabbi Meir? And indeed it is. This source is one of the many that try to give a reason. Why is Rabbi Meir always nameless? Why is he quoted anonymously? And here it's seen as a punishment. And here again, we have a trade-off. Yes, you can make sure, maybe if you're Rabbi Meir, maybe not all the rest of us, but maybe even us, we can say, you cannot ignore my questions. And indeed, sometimes we're able to ask questions that those inside, those who say your Torah doesn't belong, will not be able to ignore. But they still sometimes have power in that they are able to take away our names. And the question becomes, again, is this a worthwhile strategy? What are the costs and what are the benefits of this strategy? The benefits are, your Torah is preserved. Your Torah impacts what is happening inside the Beit Midrash. The cost is you remain outside and your name might be forgotten. I want us to look at one final story that offers, again, a different strategy, but also turns its attention not to just the question of what are the strategies that should be employed by those whose Torah doesn't belong, but also what is the responsibility of those who remain inside the Beit Midrash? If you are the one inside the Beit Midrash and you see someone who is being told they don't belong, what is your responsibility in that moment? The sages taught, after the death of Rabbi Meir, the rabbi we just saw, Rabbi Yehuda said to his students, do not let the students of Rabbi Meir enter here into our house of study because they are vexatious and they do not come to study Torah, but rather to overwhelm me with halachot. They see Rabbi Meir's students, in the words of a wonderful woman who I've studied this text with before, Nancy Feinreich, as gadflies. They're here to constantly ask annoying questions and bring up annoying ideas. And you know what? I've had enough of them. Don't let them into the Beit Midrash. And I think we've all seen this at some point or another. The people whose questions are a little too pointed and make us a little too uncomfortable. And how easy it can be to just say, that's it, I'm keeping you outside because I don't want to experience that discomfort. Sumachos. We're not going to go into this right now, but notice that his name, the student of Rabbi Meir, is Greek. He is an outsider in many ways. He is thought by some to be a convert or the son of a convert. Sumachos, a student of Rabbi Meir, pushed and entered anyway. Now, I want us to see the fourth of this strategy, the fourth one that we'll see tonight. What happens when you say, I am not going to let you keep me outside. I am going to push and enter. This is different from what we've seen before, the changing of your vernacular to something that people can hear. This is different than the you can keep me outside and I'll throw my questions in. This is saying I am going to push and I am going to get in no matter what. But this only works under certain circumstances. And let's see what those are. He pushed and entered anyway. He said to them, this is what Rabbi Meir taught me. With regard to a priest who betroths a woman with his portion of offerings, whether he did so with offerings in the most sacred order or whether he used offerings of lets or sanctity, he has not betrothed her. We're not going to get into the intricacies here. Suffice it to say, we are talking about a way of betrothing a woman. You have to give her an item. This is theoretically what if a priest gives a part of an offering, which he's not really supposed to be able to give to just a random person. Rabbi Meir said he has not betrothed her. Doesn't work. Upon hearing this, Rabbi Yehuda became angry with his students. He said to them, didn't I say this to you? Do not let the students of Rabbi Meir enter here into our house of study because they are vexatious. And they do not come to study Torah, but rather they come to overwhelm me with halachot. This halacha is not relevant. As from where would a woman appear in the temple courtyard? That's a part of the temple that women aren't really, according to halacha, women don't enter there. Women may not enter the area of the temple courtyard where the priests eat the offerings in the most sacred order. So there is no reason to address an impossible scenario. this is a halakha that no one needs. It would never happen. I don't need you to tell me about it. Rabbi Meir's students just come here to be annoying. Rabbi Yossi, who was present, said, this is another rabbi who's there and he's watching everything that's happening. And he said to himself, they will say, what will people on the outside say when they hear about this? They will say, Meir died, Yehuda grew angry, and Yossi remains silent. What will become of the words of Torah? Torah matahe alaha. What will become of Torah? And for the first time in this source, we see someone saying, if I keep this person out of the Beit Midrash, if I allow this feud to continue, what will this do to Torah? Am I honoring Torah in this moment? Am I protecting Torah in this moment? Or am I actually damaging it? Torah tma tahe alaha, what will become of Torah? And it's that question that motivates him to speak up in that moment in defense of Tzumchus. He said, in fact, this halacha is relevant. Isn't it common for a man to accept betrothal for his daughter in a temple courtyard? He's trying to say, let me think about your question. Let me think about the halacha you're proposing. And let me try to imagine a world in which it makes sense, a world in which it's possible. Isn't it possible that maybe her father could have been there and accepted it for her? And isn't it possible for a woman to designate an agent for herself to accept her betrothal in the courtyard? And furthermore, and I want us to pay attention here, what would be the halacha if the woman pushed and entered? Rabbi Yossi, who has just seen Tzumchus, the student of Rabbi Meir, push into the Beit Midrash where he wasn't wanted, said, you know what? People can sometimes push and enter where they are not technically supposed to be. And we have to imagine what are the possibilities, what new possibilities emerge when that happens. He said, that is enough for me to take this seriously. What's happening here? What's happening here is that someone on the inside is looking and saying, I want to understand the new possibilities that emerge from this question. Where you, my colleague, see just an annoyance, I see something that is pushing me to think deeper and richer and about a world of new possibilities. And he says, since all of that is possible, the halakha in such a case must be determined. I want us to close off with this. What is Tzumchus doing? Tzumchus is pushing in and he is saying, I challenge you to imagine more. You are telling me my Torah doesn't belong. I am telling you that as long as you think that way, there will be parts of reality and parts of Torah that you are not able to access. And why does it work? It works because there is someone on the inside who is willing to ask the most important question. Or at least for the sake of this conversation, when your Torah doesn't belong, what is the most important question? Torah matahe alaha, what will become of the Torah? And by that, I mean someone who is inside is standing and asking the question of, am I honoring Torah in all the forms that it can take? Am I honoring all of the possibilities inherent in Torah? And if I am, how do I listen to this question, to this idea in front of me in such a way that will create new possibilities rather than relying on keeping someone on the outside?